I'm Larry Rasmussen, and this is the first of three sessions together on Christian thinking about war and peace. What we're going to talk about today are some basic concepts with which to think about these issues. And what I would like to do tomorrow, just to look ahead, is to share a couple of the moral traditions, that is, how Christians have thought about issues of war and peace in the past. We'll see whether they are viable or not in light of the situation today. And then the third session, we'll look at a particular document, a Roman Catholic bishop's pastoral letter on war and peace, the challenge of peace, because that makes the effort to address the question of whether past Christian traditions in thinking about war and peace are viable for our setting, and talks about the setting itself, what is new in our time and place, and how we might then approach these questions. I want to start by pointing you to some of the resources in the bookstore. Mary has set out a table, and there are a lot of materials in the bookstore on war and peace issues. I have chosen just a few to highlight here, and I've chosen these not only because I think they are good materials, but because they, more than some of the other materials, address the specific topics of the next 3 days. Many of you know Jonathan Schell's book, The Fate of the Earth, which was a series that ran in New Yorker magazine, and it is a description of the probable consequences of a nuclear holocaust. It has probably had more to do with than any other single volume with the kind of resurgence now of the nuclear peace movement and other elements of a resurgence of a broad-based peace movement. Chuck Lutz and Jerry Folk, I neglected to put Jerry's name up there, Lutz and Folk, Peace Ways, 16 Christian Perspectives on Security in a Nuclear Age. And it's a wide-ranging set of essays, including some essays on biblical and theological dimensions, and that's what we're going to focus on for this session. It also has some sessions addressed to the moral traditions in the Christian faith, our subject for tomorrow, and it has some essays addressed to the present situation, security in the nuclear age. So that's a good one for all three of the topics of the next 3 days. Likewise, Ron Sider and Richard Taylor's book, Nuclear Holocaust and Christian Hope, addresses the topics of these three sessions and goes beyond and has some very concrete suggestions of what can and ought to be done, developing nonviolent modes of collective security, other things which are focused on the agenda of what to do. I think the most moving and strongest piece on biblical perspectives is one by Dale Aukerman entitled Darkening Valley, A Biblical Perspective on Nuclear War. Begins with an interpretation of Cain and Abel and the escalation of human violence to the threat to all of creation that is reflected in the Noah account, and moves on through. Darkening Valley is a most impressive piece of work. And then to share something that Dan Erlander developed for congregations as well as individuals, and is available through the Holden Resource Center, Dan's little booklet, By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb. Lutherans stand in a particular theological tradition, the theology of the cross, shared, of course, widely among Christian families, but it is Luther's theological perspective. Now, what would it mean to work out of Luther's theology of the cross and face the issues that face us today? So those are some of the resources in the bookstore. There are many others, as I mentioned. Just wander through there. Some of them are on the table, and there are more back in the corner. Last one that I didn't bring along, but I bring to your attention, and it's also in the bookstore, is John Howard Yoder's book, The Politics of Jesus, which is a pacifist's interpretation of the New Testament materials, and it's very easy to read what that would mean, even though Yoder doesn't take up the specific topics of a life in a nuclear age. It's certainly one of the most important books of the last decade in New Testament studies.
Last Friday's lecture that was taped
last Wednesday, I think. If you can't rule with the gospel, what do we do? And I recommend to you any of John Howard Yoder's tapes in the Holden tape library for the topics that we're going to be addressing. Okay. I don't know if we've got enough chairs or not, but the floor is carpeted anyway, so be comfortable. Let me cite a quotation. "I made a mistake. Without doubt, an oppressed multitude had to be liberated. But our method only provoked further oppression and atrocious massacres. My living nightmare is to find myself lost in an ocean of red with the blood of innumerable victims. It is too late now to alter the past. But what was needed to save Russia were 10 Francis of Assisi's." That passage by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin in Letters of a Modern Atheist is not often cited, either in Soviet or American or other ranks. It's not often cited either by his cultured admirers or his cultured despisers. The implications of the passage are rather harsh for most people. That is, recourse to arms is dubious as a means of justice, and the Franciscan alternative is given too much practical credence by Lenin. Neither the Kremlin nor the Pentagon is likely to endorse Lenin's confession here, especially if his haunted judgment is bound not only to Russia at the turn of the century, but transferred to other situations of revolutionary foment, such as Central America today. Another quotation to start us on our way. "We have grasped the mystery of the atom and rejected the Sermon on the Mount. The world has achieved brilliance without wisdom and power without conscience. Ours is a world of nuclear giants and ethical infants. We know more about war than we do about peace, more about killing than we do about living." Now, Omar Bradley was a 5-star general, I think one of the very few, and until his death recently, the only living 5-star general. He was widely admired, and he was deeply respected as a soldier's soldier. But this sober report from Omar Bradley sounds very ungeneral. In quarters both pacifist and military. Not unlike Lenin's belated regret about the Franciscan absence, Bradley laments the fact that so many have rejected the way of Jesus. Now, Lenin and Bradley, don't mistake me, were hardly pacifists. Neither became a convert to pacifism either, even on the deathbed. Those convictions about arms and about violence and about moral failure have their genesis somewhere else. It's in the raw experience of participation in revolution and in war. Whatever the genesis, what I want to highlight now to move on to into today's topic, the intriguing fact is this kind of unexpected turn to Francis and to Jesus. But it's a perennial attraction. And here it's set against this testimony of seasoned warriors. And that's what leads into the subject now, namely peacemaking and peacekeeping as Christian vocation. There is a theological framework for thinking about Christian peacemaking and peacekeeping. And the terms of that theological framework are set by two running themes in the biblical materials. Now, if I was doing this the right way and taking a cue from Walt Weingarten, I would tell stories in order to present those materials. We're going to do it differently, but I've learned some things about Walt about how to teach. Unfortunately, you're here before I've been able to incorporate them. But in point of fact, the biblical materials are stories. And what I'm going to do is a step removed, namely a kind of abstracting of major concepts from those stories. And those concepts then become a way of providing a framework for thinking about war and peace. I'm calling that our think wits. There's a distinction that E.F. Schumacher makes in the book Small is Beautiful between our think wits and what we think about. When we think about something, we can only do it because we have our think wits. It's something so basic to how we see things that we can't, that it shapes the outcome. We all have our think wits, or what Oliver Wendell Holmes called our can't helps, are taken for granted, our basic perceptual apparatus. Well, there's some think wits from the biblical materials that I want to be talking about. But those themselves are part of these two running themes in the biblical materials. One is the origin and destiny of creation as God's, and the other continuous biblical story, if you will, is the formation of communities of witness to creation as God's. And those two themes set the terms of Christian responsibility, namely creation and the care of it, at least that patch of creation that's affected by human power. In other words, peacemaking and peacekeeping both in nature and society. And the community of faith is the other arena of Christian responsibility, the formation and the vocation of a special called out community. That is, the other biblical story is that there is to be a visible community of worship, play, work, praise, and feasting that is also to be an agent of peacemaking and peacekeeping in creation, which is the much wider story. Sometimes the designation for that community of faith or those communities of faith is Israel among the nations. Sometimes it's the church in the world. In both cases, there's a biblical conviction that that community of witness has a special called out character with a particular vocation. If we did have time for the stories, the one I would start with would be back at the beginning, where Scripture begins. Scripture doesn't begin with Genesis, it begins with the making of a people of those who were no people, namely the marginated in Egypt, the Apiru, the Hebrews, became through the deliverance, through their liberation, a people. They found themselves in the wilderness, and here this ragtag band of folks is told that it is to be what? A nation of priests with a vocation to be holy. Now, we don't know any longer what that means because of what has happened to priesthood. But what that meant there was that people had the task to be a special called out community with a special vocation among the nations and in creation. So those two biblical themes will set the terms for thinking about war and peace. When we get to the moral traditions tomorrow, we'll find that there are two major moral traditions. One is the Christian pacifism, which relates most closely to the call of a community to be a nation of priests and with a special vocation and a very rigorous ethic. It's not expected of the wider world. And the other tradition is the just war tradition, which says there is such a thing as morally permissible use of even lethal violence for Christians. And that just war tradition is theologically grounded in that notion of creation and one's care for that. And I'll show you why this way of thinking about things, how it's related to these two themes and why then there's an ongoing debate. And it becomes fascinating when we get to the Roman Catholic bishop's letter and how they wrestle with those two in the light of present arms realities in our nation and around the world. But let's go now to the theological terrain and the four think-withs that have been used over the centuries to think about war and peace. Creation is the first one. Now, creation is a theological word for the totality of things. I know that people, when they think the word creation in common parlance, think stars and rocks and Railroad Creek and Buckskin Mountain and so on. That's not what creation means biblically. Biblically, creation includes non-human nature, but it is a word for the totality of things. When Hebrews spoke of creation, they meant everything together, land and livestock and commerce and health and family and tools and governing institutions and rocks and trees and wild animals and the sun and the moon and the stars and those cursed enemies. All things in their bundled togetherness constituted creation. Everything except God, the Creator. The primal biblical vision is that creation, in its rich diversity, is nonetheless singular. It's nicely pictured in a New Testament way of speaking of the world as an oikos, and I put the word up here. That's the Greek word, and it means, literally, it means house. But it is one way the biblical materials picture creation, namely as a large public household. Oikos is the root of our words economics, our word ecology, our word ecumenical, and if we hadn't changed and used an old English word for steward, the stiward, the keeper of the pigs, I don't know if you knew that or not, that's what steward means. The warden of the sty, the stiward. If we had used the Greek, we would see that it is the trustee of creation, the oikonomos, the trustee of the household. Economics means, biblically, providing for the household's material and service needs and managing them well. Ecumenical means treating the inhabitants of the public household as a single family and promoting the unity of that family. Ecology, a modern word but with that old vision, means a knowledge of that interdependence upon which the life of the public household or all creation depends, and as I mentioned, oikonomos or steward means the trustee or the caretaker of the public household. So I just use that because you get a vision then of creation as a singular reality that includes the totality of all things. It's interesting to me, and I'm sure Dave could cite better examples than this, that this is the testimony of modern science as well. René Dubos, famous environmental scientist and microbiologist who died not too long ago, and Barbara Ward, one of the great developmental economists of our time, together prepared a volume for the UN conference on the environment. And I just cite a paragraph from that because it is so in keeping with that ancient picture of things. There is something clarifying and irresistible in plain scientific fact The astonishing thing about our deepened understanding of reality over the last 4 or 5 decades is the degree to which it confirms and reinforces so many of the older moral insights of humanity. The philosophers told us we were one, part of a greater unity that transcends our local drives and needs. The philosophers told us that all living things are held together in a most intricate web of interdependence. They told us that aggression and violence, blindly breaking down the delicate relationships of existence, could lead to destruction and death. They were, if you like, intuitions drawn in the main from the study of human societies and behavior. What we learn now is that they are factual descriptions of the way in which our universe actually works. Or let me make the point in the words of Walter Brueggemann, Old Testament scholar. The central vision of world history in the Bible is that all creation is one, every creature in community with every other, living in harmony and security toward the joy and well-being of every other creature. And I remind you that those biblical pictures of the destiny of all things are pictures of the harmony of all things. You never just have people involved either. Look at the prophetic visions of Isaiah or the visions of the book of Revelation. It's all things together, rocks, trees, plants, institutions, people, etc. It is the totality of all things. But what about the aggression and violence, the blindly breaking down of delicate relationships of existence? Or what about creatures living in disharmony and insecurity? That too is a biblical theme. So they have an ancient picture then of the totality of all things, but also a picture of things broken, of creation in deep discord, of fissures, of pain, and violation. And that's instructive for the second think with. I'm going to skip down to justice now. What is the understanding of justice that will inform our thinking about later war and peace out of this framework? The ancient Near Eastern picture of the world portrayed life as poised precariously between a hellish chaos and a harmonious order. We always lived at the edge. The trajectory of creation itself, if you now remember the old myths, stories about creation, the trajectory in the creation accounts is a movement from chaos, the watery, the abyss, the formless and the void, to harmonious order. And when violence invades through human beings and threatens all of creation, that's what the Noah stories account, it is chaos that then overwhelms creation. And you have to start over again. So the Noah account is a retelling of the creation story. Chaos is continually intruding or threatening, and the struggle is between chaos and peace, or shalom. The forms of chaos, biblically, and now we would get back into the stories if we were doing this the right way. The forms of the chaos are such as famine and hunger, plagues and disease, mental illness, poverty, deceit and lying, marital and generational estrangement, denial of rights, denial of a fair portion of the common good to all members of society. Those are the forms of chaos. That's the form in which the intrusions are made into what is to be a harmonious order. Sin is just one name for this deep, pervasive disorder in creation. It's the triumph, however temporary, of an always threatening chaos. Now, Hebrew thinking about justice doesn't start with the prophets. They arrive very late on the scene in this particular development of this way of looking at the world. The notion of justice begins in Hebrew thinking about creation as harmonious world order. When the early Hebrew confessions say again and again that Yahweh, God, is just, It means, in the first instance, that God brings order out of chaos, that God holds back the chaos, that God balances things anew when chaos does intrude. When there's a good crop, it's understood to be the blessing of God and God's work in establishing. That's a good crop is a matter of justice. It's a little strange to our ears, but that's the way it is for the Hebrews. Justice is the achievement of, or the restoration of harmony. It's often by severe measures that this balancing, when things are disordered, happens. So in Mary's Christmas song, she talks about the poor being exalted and the rich being sent empty away. That's justice. It's a bringing about a harmonious order when things have gotten skewed. Or in the prophetic oracles, nations and empires themselves fall when their injustice provokes God's wrath and a harmonious order is restored, even through destruction. Now, such an understanding of justice needs a word or two, because it's very different from our Anglo-American notions of justice. It's much more comprehensive. Our traditions of justice usually vacillate between two meanings. We speak of justice as liberty. That means we ought to guarantee the widest range of individual choices commensurate with such choice available to others. Or we speak of justice as equality, meaning guaranteeing a relative comparative allotment of goods, services, and opportunities for as many as societal resources will permit. And then we have lots of legislation and debate and so on around which notion will dominate, justice as liberty or justice as equality, and the ways one tradition might be corrected by the other. Now, looking at creation as an oikos, as a single public household, doesn't eliminate concern for liberty and justice, but it does change the meaning and the range of justice. The basic unit of reality, if I can use a philosophical phrase, in Hebrew thinking is the whole creation in God, whereas for us, we think the basic unit of reality is a human individual.
Isn't that, though, the separation that exists between Old Testament and New Testament thought?
No, not at all. Oikos is the New Testament. When Paul talks about God's economics, oikonomia tou theou, the economy of God, It's the whole drama of redemption played out so that all things in their totality might see their achieved end. The whole creation waits groaning for the redemption. The New Testament is not individualistic. The formation, the calling of the conversion of individuals is a conversion into a new community of faith.
I guess that I look at it from the standpoint that from Hebraic thought it becomes much more community culpability. Whereas Paul, Jesus, the disciples of the New Testament community were calling for individual repentance.
There's a call to turn around and gather a new community out of the other communities, and that community takes shape around Jesus, who is understood to be head of the new community. But we'll get into this in a minute, and we'll talk a little bit more about community. Our notion of individualism is a post-Enlightenment notion, although there are real roots in the Reformation and the Renaissance as well. Our notion is that society is formed by individuals contracting with one another. It's not a very organic notion of society. The Hebrew one is a more organic picture. So, creation then biblically sees the basic unit of reality as the whole creation in God, with humanity a special strain within that. Justice, biblically, is the rendering, amidst limited resources, of that which is required for the flourishing of all of creation. I want to underscore that. Justice is the rendering, amidst limited resources, of that which is required for the flourishing of all creation, including humanity, of course. That which achieves balance and wholeness and harmony is just. The things that make for peace are the things that make for justice, and the other way around. Okay, let's take a quick...
Can you repeat the definition of justice?
Justice is the rendering, amidst limited resources, of that which is required for the flourishing of all creation. The ancient definition of justice is rendering that which is due. And then you have a long debate for a millennium now on what is due whom, etc. And that's why I use the phrase rendering what is due. But the important point is it's what is due for all creation.
Is that the Hebrew? Are you talking now about the
Hebrew? Yeah, yeah. Now, peace, the next term here, is also another biblical think with. And the word now, which is a common one, and we even use it for both greetings and saying goodbye, shalom. And Mary Schramm will do a Bible study on Saturday morning. We'll fill out the meaning of that term much more than we can do in this short time. Shalom is often rendered as peace. It's really a summary term for God's hopes for creation. It's shared abundance and full health in every sphere. Shalom is well-being extended to all creatures. It's life lived without debilitating fear. It is tranquility and serenity, but it's much more than that. Shalom is also bread. Shalom is dance. Shalom is just a word that means total well-being in every area. So that means the antonym of shalom is not simply war. War is one of the forms of chaos that threatens shalom. But in a positive way, shalom making and shalom keeping runs the gamut of human activity, so that planting and harvesting is doing shalom. Commerce, if it provides for the flourishing of creation, is a matter of shalom making and shalom keeping. Child rearing and parent caring, or making friends, making treaties, making love, those are all activities of shalom. Making music, caring for victims, providing sound bodily care, feasting, offering protection and security, worshiping, anything that intersects the care of creation belongs to peacemaking and to peacekeeping in this way of looking at things. I want to jump to our situation for a minute. If we say shalom is more than war avoidance, that needs a severe qualification in our time, a qualification which is much more severe than for biblical communities of faith. But it needs a qualification precisely because of the same understanding of peace that belong to those communities. Weapons of mass destruction, that's not only nuclear weapons, but those in the first instance, pose the unprecedented possibility of a victory of chaos over at least our patch of creation. There is no previous war, however horrible its holocaust locally, that ever threatened to foreclose on the possibility of future generations. We've never been in that situation, where one had the real chance of closing down ongoing life. None had the capacity to render the planet virtually dead and its atmosphere no longer conducive to the fertile evolution of countless species. when we see the pictures of movies of the possible consequence of nuclear war, it doesn't sometimes occur to people that it isn't simply the destruction of the moment. It is rendering the atmosphere unable to provide that which is provided, the evolution of ongoing species, not just human life. So we haven't been in a situation where we had the capacity to bring earthly life to a close. A new epoch is upon us, and it makes the word Holocaust all too possible. In Greek, the word Holocaust means the consumption by fire of all that is. Even the most apocalyptic strife in the biblical imagination is unprepared for the kind of destruction that nuclear Holocaust portends. For in nuclear Holocaust, there is not even the biblical picture of a new heaven and a new earth and a saved community. There's only a cinder in an empty space. A nuclear Holocaust would mean that the object of the Creator's unbounded affection, namely the world, would be irreparably poisoned. So while shalom, biblically, means more than the absence of war, it has now to mean, at least minimally, the avoidance of nuclear fire. If not, then the peace of creation that is our only home is placed in the utmost jeopardy. And that shalom is more than war avoidance needs another qualification, another comment anyway. Anyway, if you work with this understanding of peace, then all kinds of questions come up when you ask about peacemaking and peacekeeping that are questions beyond the question, how do you avoid war or how do you restrain it if it breaks out? You have to ask questions like, what are the full costs of the military enterprise to the full flourishing of creation? Do guns and bombs kill even when they are not used? That some genuine needs of peacekeeping and peacemaking can sometimes be met by the armed forces and by the police is not in doubt. That is, part of shalom is protection and a measure of security. Those are essential in a disordered, broken, and violent world, and they can't be had without a price. There's that biblical realism as well. But an assessment must ask about more things than protected borders or war avoidance or the costs of overt conflict if and when it comes. You have to try to tally the overall costs as best you can. What are the economic costs of peacetime preparedness or wartime preparedness during peacetime? What are the economic who pays for that, and who benefits? What vital resources and societal wealth are drained from the common good? Where are human genius and skill and energy directed, and what areas suffer from the neglect of that direction? Are human rights suspended, or perhaps never acknowledged or granted in the first place, in the name of a security that's defined by certain military, police, and governing authorities in certain places? What is done and what is left undone when the defense sector of societies grows to gargantuan dimensions? Those are all questions you would have to ask out of thinking of peace in terms of shalom. And Dave will take up some of that in his own way in a session later this week on the military-industrial complex. So all I want to say is that when we think peace, if you want to use a biblical think with, you don't take the measure of peace by only asking about wars and the avoidance of wars, no matter whether large or small. The order of shalom is too multifaceted for that narrow a gauge, and the forms of death are as many as are the forms of life. Okay, lastly, and I ask your patience on these basic categories in the hopes that it enhances our discussion later. Church or faith community. I haven't mentioned that. Actually, church is not the best term, and I'm going to use communities of faith or faith communities, because most of the drama biblically revolves around Israel's pilgrimage. And yet, we're talking about as a Christian community, and so I will spend some time with the vocation of the church. The vocation, whether one talks about Israel or the church, is the same. Namely, the witness to God's hope for all of creation by becoming communities of visibly redeemed creation. The vocation of Israel among the nations or the church in the world is to reflect in its own life that which God hopes for all creation. The believing community is to show in its own life the justice doing of God. It is to be an anticipatory community, anticipatory of renewed or redeemed creation, a kind of aperitif of the kingdom come. That makes the community's formation and its reformation a vital arena of responsibility. It's not an exaggeration to say that Christian social ethics is first and foremost the organization of the shalom community around the imitation of Christ. And then the relationship of that community to the wider world is the other area of Christian social ethics. The community, the biblical community's experience is instructive here. As I mentioned, the formative event of peoplehood, of making of no people a community, happens in the Exodus, and that event led inevitably to a question and a task. How do we now, those of us who have experienced this liberating God, embody in our community life the freedom that has been won for us and the hope that we carry from this delivery? Sinai is the answer. Those years in the wilderness are the answer to how this people become a people is to become a community. The wilderness task is that one. Freedom from something has to issue in freedom for something. That is, freedom must, or the experiencing deliverance, must find institutional form. So, what they set themselves out to do, and this is where the Ten Commandments and all kinds of other legislation comes in, is that community formation. How should the believing community pursue its own economic life? What should be its own polity and politics? What form should its worship take? What should be its social intercourse and the nature of its ties to its neighbors? And the clue for the answer was that it should reflect in its own character and its own conduct the character and the conduct of the righteous and the compassionate God. People get bored with all of that legislation in Exodus and Deuteronomy and Leviticus. Go back and read it sometime and see where the legislation takes its cue. It always says, Yahweh did such and so. Therefore, Yahweh rescued the stranger. Therefore, we must not turn the stranger away at the gate or oppress the stranger. If God visited us as slaves in Egypt, then we must have a jubilee every once in a while and have the slave released. Indeed, we should show God's compassion and love the neighbor, including the stranger, even the enemy, as ourselves. Well, lots of times it didn't work out. I mean, all of that stinks of human frailty when you go back and read it too. But you see the same dynamics at work in the early church. The experience of the resurrection and the giving of the Spirit at Pentecost lead to very practical efforts. Read the book of Acts again. It's a community now. It's folks who have had a transforming experience, and they said, we have seen life. We have experienced shalom. What then is the task? The task is to embody that in the new community. What shall we do with our goods? What shall we do now with the houses we own? What shall we do with our land? How shall we organize fellowship with one another? How do we break bread together with members of the body in Jerusalem? That's the question in the church in Corinth. How are we going to do that? How shall our worship be conducted? Who does what? And in what manner? How is authority established? And how are jobs doled out in the community? What do we say to Caesar now and his army? What do we say to the tax collectors? The answers, again, only satisfactory in limited degree, and they're constantly being debated and scrutinized, cannot be understood apart from the experience of Jesus and the Jesus community.
Now, by the Spirit, all discipleship becomes the way in which this new believing community carries on the Hebrew tradition of the imitation of God. The Old Testament ethic is an effort to constantly understand the character of God so that we can reflect the character of God in our own conduct. The New Testament community looks to Christ and the imitation of Christ to shape its community life. Now, quickly, that means a rigorous ethic for the community. Both Israel and the early church pose more exacting standards for their ethic and their own land than they expect of the surrounding world. Why? Because the clues for their conduct and their character are the qualities of life that are present when God's justice is done in creation. They have to reflect that. The Sermon on the Mount is the ethic of the kingdom to come on earth as in heaven. It's the way of life in renewed creation. It's the way of the peacemaking God. It's not like the Lutherans have told you to draw convince you of your sin to drive you to Christ by showing you what you can't do. Not it. It is the ethic of new creation, and it is the ethic of the new community. Now, that you can't always do it is clearly the case. And then the peacemaking God lets you start all over by saying, okay, you're forgiven, go for it again. Okay, so two arenas of Christian responsibility when we start to get into issues of war and peace. One arena of Christian responsibility, creation and its care, the doing of justice, that all things might flourish in peace. And then the second arena of Christian responsibility, the formation and the vocation of the community of faith, so that the shalom that God intends for all creation might be identified, pointed to, talked about, proclaimed, and made visible. You can see it in play. You can see it in worship. You can see it in cooking and commerce and the way people order their community. Is there a connection between these two? I just passed this along because it's also the way biblical communities looked at things. The biblical communities of faith carry the conviction that creation is a moral order and that God is its author and guardian, author of the moral order and the guardian of that moral order. When the believing community adheres to the Creator's moral order, it is a blessing for all of life. There's a touch of arrogance here. The believing community thinks that when it's doing what God intends of it, all of creation benefits from that. That a well-ordered community life spills over into a well-ordered life for the nature around it. You may have troubles with that. I don't blame you for having troubles with that, you think. But that is a conviction. Also, when the community violates the moral order of creation, it jeopardizes the rest of creation. So the Hebrews are always trying to figure out, good grief, why that earthquake? What did we do wrong? There's a connection between the life of the community and the whole life of the wider world. So nature as well as society and psyche suffer the consequences of injustice. Again, this becomes fascinating for us, but because of a different situation, our situation is that human power has expanded so dramatically, so that nature as well as society and psyche do now suffer from human injustice. And again, the situation with which we're posed, namely the presence of weapons of mass destruction, does make this ancient biblical insight something real in its consequences for us. Human injustice, and it becomes almost irrelevant to ask the question who started it, if it happened, does have consequences for nature as well as society and psyche. So the conviction then is that creation is a relatively harmonious sphere if the called out community is true to its covenantal vocation. When the covenantal vocation is lost and society turns away from compassion and righteousness, the character of God, then the more devastating acts of God occur. That's what the insurance companies call them. Now that's the occasion for those acts of God. God then struggles to beat back total chaos, often using the very enemies of the community of faith, or in this case, unfaith. Didn't I make a covenant with the Assyrians too? He asks in Amos, when the Israelites had broken their covenant. Or I'll appoint Cyrus, the pagan king, as Messiah, God's anointed one, to bring things into order, even though it means that you will lose the nation you have been, and you will spend the years in exile. Those acts of God, struggling to beat back total chaos, often using the very enemies of the community of faith, in order to restore the essential moral lines of the universe. So then, the condition of creation and the condition, the moral and spiritual condition of the community, are corollaries of one another in the biblical account. That's the underlying assumption that often is made explicit in the dire warnings of the prophets. And I should also say it's also an assumption that supports the promise of blessing, because when the community's condition is one of justice, then the wider creation benefits as well, is blessed in that biblical term. All right, I'm not going to even start on the specifics now of what that means for questions of war, peace, violence, and nonviolence. That's what we'll take up tomorrow. I just wanted to take the time today to talk about some of these biblical perspectives that really arise out of the stories of creation, the stories of the Exodus, the stories of the drama of the Hebrew people. I appreciate your patience. Normally, we wouldn't take this much time for what has been essentially a monologue. It's hard to get into the next two sessions without starting here. So we still have some time. Let's discuss a bit. Questions, replies, comments, whatever.
You're there?
Yeah.
I'm a little confused or troubled by the word harmony and order, in the sense that it sounds like harmony and order is good.
Yeah.
And yet, quite often, we end up with, say, our military-industrial complex is a system of mutually reinforcing behaviors, in a sense that has a harmony and an order, and that those who question it are criticized for disrupting the order that's there, just like the prophets were.
Yeah.
And we look at, say, the Japanese military-industrial complex in World War II, harmony was an important part. People wanted to fit in and contribute to the whole, and the same thing with the German concept of the folk.
Yeah.
So how does that harmony become demonic, in the sense where, and then God sends people, the prophets, to disrupt the harmony,
mm-hmm.
the false harmony mm-hmm. that's there.
Mm-hmm.
How can we get language to deal
yeah,
with that?
Yeah, exactly, and I'm glad you bring that up, because first of all, there isn't any doubt that there is a picture of a harmony and order, and that's creation when it's flourishing. That is that picture. But in our notions, it can be a static understanding, and as you say, it can really be the organization of injustice.
And the arms race.
Yeah.
It's a reinforcing behavior.
Yeah. I guess I would want to approach it this way. One must keep in the forefront that it is all of creation that must be flourishing in order to have the order that God speaks of or creates. If you have order that is not promotive of the flourishing, the well-being, the total health of things, then that order is the one that gets disrupted. That is a form of chaos. The Nazi order was a form of organized chaos. If you want to use biblical language, you have to keep in the forefront the picture of justice as foremost.
And with God outside of creation, then it is God's order. It's not just order, any old kind of order.
Yeah.
But I guess the part I'm uncomfortable with in terms of the words in our present context.
Yes.
Is that quite often the most unjust systems
are the most orderly.
Are the most orderly. In fact, I was reading in your office Martin Luther King's reply to this criticism, well, you're creating disorder. And he said, yes, I am, because of the injustice. So we have to sort those words out.
As I say, the only way I know how to respond to that is to say, is there a picture of the order itself that is to be the order of creation? And there is that. And so one takes one's cues for any other order by matching it up against that picture of a flourishing creation. So you can't have master-slave, you can't have oppressed oppressors, you can't have people living at the edge of poverty and other ranks in the same society living in unrestrained affluence and call that the order intended for creation, even though it in that society may be the way things are ordered. It's also a good idea, I think, and I'm grateful for the comment about watching the language. Order itself is not really the best term for describing creation. In the translations of even the creation accounts, the proper translation to reflect the Hebrew verb is not "in the beginning God created," but "in the beginning of creation." The notion is an ongoing process. Creation continues. And so we ought to be saying ordering, probably, in order to catch some of the dynamism there, rather than order, which does have a terribly static picture. That's just another place where the language probably doesn't facilitate the notion.
All the order and harmony which you speak of lost and sin entered the world.
Yeah, that's why the picture is one of disordered and fallen and broken creation that is always poised somewhere between a more harmonious order that struggles to come into being and the biblical picture of chaos or intrusion.
Will we have that same chaos, so to speak, until Christ comes the second coming?
The second coming is a way of talking about the end of that or the coming of the kingdom. And there are several different pictures of it.
I guess what I'm confused is I'm not too certain whether you're trying to say that, you know, wars and poverty and oppression and you know, everything else which is there, which is speaking in the gospel, will not be ended until Christ makes his second coming. Are you saying that we can live some of those things before he comes?
Oh yeah, the picture in the New Testament is that you both have the reality of new creation in the present as well as the consummation of that in the future. It is a present reality. The kingdom on earth as in heaven is another way of talking about that. Glimpses of creation redeemed. That creation redeemed isn't only a future reality biblically. It is also a present reality.
Well, when Christ spoke of the end, the signs of the end, didn't he include all of these things that they would still be there at that time? From Matthew? That the, you know, until the last days, of which we don't know when that will be, that there would be rumors of war and poverty,
yes,
and ruination. And,
yes.
I mean, as sad as those things are, those things will be with us until he makes that second appearance.
Oh, yeah, but it isn't a matter of indifference about the time between. The time between is has its part in the redeeming of creation. And it's a real possibility. It's not simply grin and bear it. You will always have war and violence and poverty and the kind of acceptance. You don't get that at all. It wasn't accepted in the community around Jesus. They started organizing practically to eliminate that so as better to reflect the kingdom. And there's a real confidence that in the Spirit that can be shared widely. It isn't a fatalism about conditions of disordered creation.
How did that square then with what John saw in Revelation about the seals being broken and all these
things? You have several different pictures of the kind of strife or the drama of creation before a kind of the destiny of creation as harmonious world order is realized. You go all the way from a picture of the destruction of this creation as the way through to a new creation, very apocalyptic pictures, often very violent ones. You go all the way from that emphasis on tremendous breaks, discontinuity, to things which are much more gradual, where it's assumed that people can order their own lives in a new way, and you can have the upbuilding of the kingdom. The biblical materials are not of a single mind on that. And we simply must recognize you're talking about lots of communities and lots of different
places. Well, you touched
places
on something earlier too, and I think this is important, that is that all of creation groans and waits.
Yeah.
For what?
Yeah. Redemption.
Redemption through Christ.
And that's another picture of this interesting corollary between communities being redeemed in the present and in an ongoing way, and the condition of the wider world. That's there as well. Paul thinks that about those little churches in Ephesus and Corinth and other places. They're part of the drama of the economy of God, to use the New Testament term. They're part of that, and it ramifies through creation itself. But that isn't simply a matter only of the end. That's also a matter of the present. Nor is it a matter only, is the only picture one of cataclysm. There's also the formation of communities that can anticipate that order of harmony. And that's what the vocation of the community is. Okay, tomorrow we'll get more specific about how this relates to thinking in particular about issues of violence and nonviolence, war and peace, and then take it on Wednesday to present arms race, and even the Roman Catholic bishops take on the Reagan administration. So it gets more specific and more interesting.
Tune in.
Yes.
Tune in tomorrow.